women who are outside of that marriage relationship or don't have a partner called to ministry, the understanding is that they are serving in lesser roles. The ideal woman in ministry is a woman married to a minister.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
It's an absolute pleasure to welcome Dr. Beth Ellison Barr to the podcast this afternoon. Beth, would you start by just telling us a little bit about your own faith journey? Did you grow up in a Christian home?
I did grow up in a Christian home. In fact, I don't really remember a time when I didn't know about God and when I wasn't in church. So I think we call it here the cradle role. I'm sure I was on the cradle role from my very early stages. And my parents were my first Bible teachers.
Oh, that's really beautiful. A lovely testimony. At what point, though, did it become a faith that you sort of felt like you owned for yourself?
Yeah. So when I was, I was 11 years old. I actually know this. I asked my mom not too long ago when I was baptized, and I was baptized in 1986, and I was born in 75, so I was 11. And I remember praying with my older sister on my bed, and that was at that point when I wanted to have a relationship with Jesus. And then I was baptized several months later in our family church, and I remember all my family being there with me.
Oh, that's such a lovely story. So for you, faith has always been there. Has it always been a constant? Have there been ups and downs, or have you always had sort of a fairly even faith?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the sense that I've never questioned the reality of God, and I've never questioned in many ways Christianity itself, it has been a relatively even faith. But I have had lots of questions along the way. And there has been a lot, there have been moments where I didn't understand what God was doing. Sometimes I still don't understand what God is doing. But the faith that that God is there and that God cares for me and wants to have a personal relationship with me, that has always been a strength in my life.
And what were some of those moments where faith was difficult, or you had to deal with those questions?
Yeah. So I would say when I was in graduate school, that I was, when I was really beginning to learn more about the history of my faith and about the history of how women were treated by Christianity. And that, those caused moments of pause for me where I did struggle and wondered, you know, like what does it mean if throughout the Christian tradition there has been so much harm done to people? What does that mean about my faith? And so those were things that I did grapple with. And as I grew into my faith and as my husband and I moved into ministry, those questions didn't go away. And so I think that there's something that I'm still dealing with. And in 2016, everything came to the forefront when my husband lost his job at a church over the issue of women in ministry. And it really was a hard moment where I thought, you know, God, we're doing everything right. We've done everything that you've asked us to do. We have taught the Bible faithfully. And now our friends and family have turned on us. And it was a very challenging moment.
So for those people who are listening to the podcast who don't know who you are or what you do, you're a professor of history, and you specialize in the very, you know, in a slightly niche area of medieval church history and the role of women in that. You teach at a university, at Baylor University in Texas. And you've written a couple of books. One, the first one, which features quite heavily that story you just mentioned about your husband losing his job. So would you tell us a little bit more about that? What happened, and why did it inspire you to write about it and to really get stuck into these issues?
Yes. So we have always been in evangelical churches. We've been in the Baptist tradition as well as in non-denominational traditions. And we were at a church, we'd been at it for about 15 years. And it was a church that never had allowed women in the highest leadership positions. So they couldn't, say, be the senior pastor of the church. But women had always served in a whole variety of other positions within the church and were pretty visible in the church when we first got there. But over the past few years, we had been seeing women being pushed out. And in fact, women almost completely disappearing from the stage and women not being allowed to teach adult classes. And this was happening at the same time that my understanding of women in the Bible and women in church history was also growing. And both my husband and I were beginning to question more the limits that we saw being placed upon women within church spaces. And this was especially poignant to us because we dealt with teenagers. Mm-hmm. And it became increasingly difficult when teenage girls would come to us and say that they felt called to ministry. And the response that the church wanted us to give was that they could only be called to certain types of ministry, you know, that there were limits on them that weren't on the young boys. And we were grappling with this because we did not believe that God placed limits on ministry based upon gender. And so it all kind of came to a head when we had the opportunity to have a female co-leader in the high school in the 9th through 12th grade class. And we had to petition to ask for this because the church at this point no longer allowed women in these spaces. And the church told us no. And I remember my husband came to me and he said, if we push this, I will lose my job. He knew at that point. And we decided that this was a moment where we felt like we needed to stand up for what we thought that what we believed the Bible actually taught about women's roles in the church. And so my husband lost his job 3 weeks later.
Wow, that's so harsh. I think for people listening in the UK here, we would probably feel quite shocked about that.
Yes.
Is that kind of thing very common in the US?
Oh, yes. I would say, especially in the environment right now, as churches really have taken this hard conservative turn, especially on women's roles in the church. So this is a very common story. In fact, I have heard from so many people since publishing my first book, as well as my second book, on how their stories paralleled mine. And so this is, I think as we move into church systems that are being run by smaller and smaller groups of leaders who are less willing to receive criticism and less willing to receive, to have people who differ on theological issues, that the sort of go-to, if you have somebody in leadership in the church who challenges you, you lose your job. And that's becoming a pretty common narrative.
Wow, that feels very extreme and not a particularly good example for the church to be setting.
I agree. It's a very problematic. I think it also, if you think about the larger US society right now, we're a very polarized society where there aren't a lot, having conversations together is difficult. And I think the church is, instead of the church being the voice to help bring the US together and to foster conversations and to remind us that we are all part of the kingdom of God, the church is part of this polarization. And I think we see this in this lack of toleration of differing theological perspectives, especially perspectives that have nothing to do with the gospel of Jesus.
Mm. It's very interesting, isn't it, to me? One of the things I was really eye-opening for me reading your books was how you explain these modern views around the roles of different genders in churches, what we might call complementarianism and egalitarianism, yeah. Where one party believes that only men can do certain roles and egalitarians believe that men and women can do both roles equally, that they are actually very modern phenomena. Reading how you unpick the modern societal and historical influences that have created the environment for these to come, rather than there being this biblical basis, which is kind of, you know, right. I think we all assume these two sides have a biblical base behind them, and you know, those that purport to believe either side or the other have these views based on scripture. How would you explain it to someone who's new to this area? What are the two roles and where does this, why has this sort of modern view of complementarian, where's it come from?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think this is what surprises most people, because most people assume that throughout church history, that there has been a relatively consistent view on women in the church, and that women mostly have not been allowed to serve in leadership roles. And so therefore, any deviation from that is a deviation from biblical teachings, from biblical truth. That's the complementarian argument. Complementarian comes from a meeting in the 1980s. We know exactly when it happened. It was a group of men who were part of the Evangelical Theological Society who were very concerned about women having more visible roles in the church, and were very concerned about women working outside the home and, you know, essentially moving into much more equal place in U.S. society. And they saw this as a threat to biblical values. And so they decided to start a movement to restore biblical values, what they called biblical values, to the home and to the church, and thus to broader society. And they decided that the term patriarchy, which is the term that is just simply a catch-all term for male rule, essentially in society or church or family or whatever, they decided that that had a negative connotation. And so they decided to use a term called complementarian, which was actually a scientific term talking about the complementary of the sexes, the male and the female body. And they decided that sounded like a much better term. And so they coined it, that the complementarian movement, the movement for restoring biblical values to the home and to the church in terms of female leadership. It is at this point that another group of Christians who were horrified by this got together and were sort of like, no, that's actually not what the Bible teaches. The Bible says there's no limits based on gender on what women and men are called to do. And in response to this complementarian framework, they coined themselves egalitarian, and this idea that there's full equality, that that women and men before God are fully equal and fully able to serve in any sort of leadership roles that God calls them to.
Mm. And most people would, I think, assume that generally with regards to gender, we are on a sort of a progressive arc, that, you know, particularly in the UK, you know, we've in the Church of England, we've just celebrated 30 years of female ordination. Yes. Many denominations in the UK are perfectly happy with female ordination. Why do you think, like, in modern times, have we gone backwards almost in some sections of the church?
That's a really good question. I think part of it does stem, part of it stems from broader social anxiety. And we see this throughout history. You know, history really helps me to have a look at this. Whenever there's when there's significant social upheaval, and in the context of the emergence of complementarian, it's in the post-World War II era. And we know that historically this disrupted society significantly. And like in the US, when the men came home from the war, there was a push to try to get them into college and to get them into jobs, which meant a push to get women who had been serving, and I know this happened in the UK too, that women who had been serving in those workplace environments suddenly were being asked to take a back step, to step out of them. And we see a lot of emphasis being put, like, you know, a woman's proper place is the home. Wouldn't you want to go back home and just take care of your kids and let men go into the workspace? And this was all part of this trying to restore what they considered normalcy in the post-World War II era. And this is going to impact also the church, because the idea was, if we're going to restore normalcy, we've got to get men back in that proper leadership role where they've been absent from because of the war. And so we've got to restore these biblical values. There was also a lot of, I think, fear about women moving into leadership roles. We see women moving into political roles. It's during this time in the U.S. too that we see women being, you know, there's rules now that you have to pay women for the same work that you pay men for, which seems like a no-brainer, but that was caused a lot of anxiety. Also, that you can't fire pregnant women, which also seems like a no-brainer, but there was, you know, very an understanding that if you, a woman got married or pregnant, that that was terms for her to be fired and that it was okay to do that. And now we had laws that said that wasn't possible. And then we also see education opening up. And in the U.S., we saw an unprecedented number of women going to seminary, to theological training, and they were enrolling in classes that would lead to the pastoral position. And this is when we see this pushback. So it's at a time where there were significant social advancements that were making it easier for women to move into leadership positions across the board. And then we see this backlash, which also historically happens. You know, this is, we see this throughout history, but it happened with quite a vengeance in the 1970s and the 80s and is has grown into this biblical womanhood, manhood movement that has become very powerful.
So you see this as a weaponization of scripture in response to external pressures and fears?
Absolutely. You know, a clear example of this, for example, and I don't, is we can think about the changes in Bible translations. So, for example, we think about Junia, who is mentioned in Romans 16 as an apostle. We also can think about Phoebe, who is mentioned as, who is called a deacon. And she's the only named deacon of a specific church that we have in the Bible is of a woman. So you can think about those two women. And in the 19th century, at the same time, that this will also be familiar to the UK, the fight for women's suffrage began. We see a shift in Bible translations, where for the first time, Junia begins to be translated across the board as Junius, which is a name that didn't exist. And there's only a couple of times throughout all of church history that anybody has proposed this before. This is truly a phenomenon that starts in the late 19th century during the suffrage, the fight for women's suffrage. And you can see the connection there that if we're saying women should not ever be in political or leadership roles, then, oh my gosh, definitely Junia should not actually have been an apostle unless she was male. And so they change her name to Junius. And this becomes encoded in our on many of our modern Bible translations. Now it's actually been changed back because there's no grounding for that change. And so people have had to go back to having Junia. But nonetheless, you know, for you can think about generations of people who read the Bible with that as a masculine name. Another example is the rise of the English Standard Version, which I know is all over the UK right now, because when I go into medieval churches, for example, like St. Helen's Bishopgate in downtown London, it's one of my favorite churches. And when I go in, I remember going in there several years ago and taking a picture. For those who don't know, it's the only medieval evidence, it's only medieval church structure in London that has evidence of the female monastic community that was part of it. So it has a double nave in the, and so I was up in the balcony taking a picture of the double nave, and I looked down and I saw all of the chairs had the ESV in it. And I just, my heart just sank, because the English Standard Version was a product of this fight for complementarians. And it was a retranslation that was done by the founders of the complementarian movement in the US for the express purpose of making it look like women should not be in leadership roles. So they rewrote parts of scripture. You know, most of the the ESV is the RSV, the Revised Standard Version. They only changed a very small amount. Almost all of them have to do with women in leadership roles. One of the most egregious was in Genesis 3, in which the curse of Eve, instead of your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you, they changed it to your desire will be contrary to your husband and he will rule over you. And for over a decade, that was the translation used in English Standard Versions, which is, I think, the third most popular Bible in the world right now.
Wow. Wow. That's really eye-opening, isn't it? And
yes.
It's quite concerning, I think, for the average Christian who doesn't know Greek or Hebrew or Latin and has never really dug into all of those kinds of issues, to think that so much rests on so few words and
yes,
so few people translating those words and so much historical context around what was going on at the time of that translation. So
yeah,
what would you say to those people who lob those, you know, those killer verses around from Paul about women should remain silent and, you know, the husband is the head?
Yeah.
How does that line up with saying, no, all of this is not scriptural? Women are equally positioned to lead and to teach and to preach and do all of those things.
Yeah. So I grew up in Bible study all of my life. And one of the things that Bible study teachers always say is go back to the Bible. When you have questions about interpretation, go back to the Bible. So if you're going to say that that in Timothy, that Paul gives a directive for women to not serve in leadership positions, but to be silent and to to not hold leadership over men, even going back to 1 Corinthians, to ask their husbands at home. If you're going to say that that is a statement that was given not to particular churches who are having particular problems, in which Paul was stepping in and writing letters directly to them, which is what the epistles are, if you're saying that those are actually should be applied to all people at all time, then you've got to compare that with the rest of Scripture. And what we see throughout the rest of Scripture is that women are not silent. Women are empowered by God to serve in leadership positions, some of them directly by God. I mean, think about Deborah, the judge. Think about Huldah. Think about Miriam. Think about even the fact that the very first person in the Bible who names God is actually Hagar. And she names God the God who sees, women like her. And so if you take those verses and say they have to be applied to everyone at all time, and then you apply them to the Bible, you realize it doesn't work, because women are serving in visible leadership roles empowered by God and even empowered by Paul. You just read Romans 16 and we see 10 women there, named women who are in leadership positions in the early church. And no one really cares who their husbands are. They're serving in leadership roles, empowered by Paul and empowered by the early church.
So talking about husbands, let's move on to the themes of your latest book, The Making of the Pastor's Wife, of which you are one, incidentally.
Yes.
You're married to a pastor, and you've already shared a little bit of one of the most traumatic experiences that you guys have had to endure as a married couple. But at what point did you start to realise that what you felt called to do and to be, in terms of your very, very impressive academic career, somehow at odds with parts of what the church expected you to do and to be as someone who was married to a pastor?
Yeah, absolutely. It started pretty early on. I can remember very early on, I was in graduate school. I was working on my PhD. There were a whole lot of expectations that were on me that I had to fulfill to get this degree. And yet there were also always sort of this pull from the church that I was expected to be at all of the services, that I was expected to be a leader, that I was expected to teach, especially, you know, we were at a very small church. And so they needed a lot of help. And I mostly am always willing, to help. But it was when I was like, I really don't have time to do this. I need to be home working on this thing. And instead, I'm doing fulfilling these expectations at church. And at first, you know, I had internalized what I had been taught as an evangelical woman growing up in these spaces. And one of the things, you know, for this most recent book, I read 150 pastor's wife books, which I think, you know, can allow me to talk about what they said. And one of the things they teach is that when you feel frustrated with what your expectations are at church, you feel like, you know, there's other things you want to do, that usually the problem is your heart, that your heart's not in the right place, that you have not given yourself over fully to this ministry. And so a lot of this I struggled in myself. I thought it was me. I thought the problem was me, that I was prideful. And so a lot of that I took to God. You know, I was like, God, if this is what you want, help me to be this, help me to give, to make these sacrifices. And instead, what I felt was God continuing to push me the other direction and continue to show me, like through what I was learning, and even through examining the Bible, that those are not actually expectations that God was putting on me, that they were coming externally, through the church, but external to what it meant to be a woman serving out, you know, the call on my life. And that, I think, kind of gave me the courage to start examining the historical origins of this concept of biblical womanhood, and then this concept of the pastor's wife. And the pastor's wife role brings together a lot of what I argued in The Making of Biblical Womanhood, and shows how it became embodied in this particular idealized woman who is the pastor's wife, and how through the pastor's wives, churches were also able to begin to push women out of independent leadership roles, because they could argue that, yes, of course, we support women in ministry. Look at our pastor's wife. And she's the one, she's serving God through her marriage. And women who are outside of that marriage relationship or don't have a partner called to ministry, that they are not, you know, the understanding is that they are serving in lesser roles. The ideal woman in ministry is a woman married to a minister.
This August in Premier Christianity magazine, we dive into justice, music, and football. Lawyer Janice Machemi talks about campaigning for the powerless, worship leader Pat Barrett on Christian music's big comeback, and Premier League legend John Bostock, who leads Ballers in God. Subscribe for 12 months at $44.99 and receive a free copy of Inspired, the best-selling book by Simon Gilbo. Sign up at premierchristianity.com.
I've got to admit, I've spent a lot of the last 2 weeks reading this book before I go to sleep, and it's funny, but it's not funny. Just reading out quotes from that you've quoted from other publications about the types of things that have been expected of pastors' wives, and some of them, you know, shockingly recent, like quotes from the early 2000s that basically, you know, reduce a woman's role to studying her husband and supporting him through and in everything at the detriment of everything else, that they just frankly feel like they should have been relegated to the 1950s. And I'm reading them out to my husband, and he's laughing, and then you realize you're laughing about something, but it's also deeply, deeply serious, because it is so damaging to women and to the church, quite frankly.
Absolutely.
I'm like slightly horrified that people actually still think things like this. And also, just, it's funny because, again, in a UK context, you know, I think that probably not quite as systemized, but also there is just a huge expectation of this kind of two-for-one role that comes along with marriage in the church, that which really needs addressing, because it's not okay to like you say, it's okay to volunteer if you want to volunteer and that's where your heart is, but it's not okay to expect it, is it, as part of the employment model?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've talked with a lot of women who feel called to pastoral positions. And one of the challenges with them finding jobs in the U.S. Is that Search committees are much more likely to hire a male pastor who comes with this extra piece, who they know is also going to serve in the church and do all of these these positions they need, whereas a female pastor, her husband is much less likely to be involved in those types of ways, and nobody expects him to. So you get less for hiring a female pastor than you do for hiring a male pastor. And so this is one of the reasons why women have a harder time getting pastoral positions.
Now, I know you are based in the US, but also that you do actually spend a lot of the time in the UK, and that you, obviously a lot of your research is into the English church and the European church in medieval times. So what is your view as an American of how this particular issue impacts the UK church?
Yeah. So, you know, when I think I first started, when I didn't know as much about the UK church, I really saw, because there's been ordination of women in the UK for such a long time, and I would always meet female, female priests, and it was such a different environment for me that I sort of had this idea that the UK in general was much more open to women serving in all types of these roles. And one of those things too, it's like, oh yeah, there's a female bishop, but what you don't think about is that that's one female bishop representing all women, because there's no one else. There's not very many other ones serving in those roles. But at the time, I didn't quite realize that. And it wasn't until I really started studying the rise of this complementarian movement in the US that I began tracing how it was spreading outward. And one of the places it really has targeted is the UK. And you can see this through some of the missionary, some of the groups, like, for example, like the Gospel Coalition and Desiring God Ministries, who would send out preachers from the US who would go to UK pulpits, especially more evangelical churches. And so you can think about, even in the Anglican system, that there is this evangelical revival, which is great, because a lot of, you know, they're doing a lot of really good things, but they also have become much more open to these U.S. influences, I think, that are bringing this very traditional, it's not really traditional, that's just what we call it, but this very constrained understanding of women and women's service in the church. And so you see it moving in. And as you know, I gave the example of the English Standard Version of the Bible, which has become quite common in the UK. And those are bleeding over from the US. And I find that really worrisome. seeing what has happened in the US, I find it really worrisome to see those influences moving into the UK. They also tend to come with things like Christian nationalism, which is worrisome too.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I would say, especially in more evangelical circles, it's sometimes kind of what I might call a soft complementarianism. Yes. Like, even in churches where women are allowed to preach and to teach, there's still a sort of often an unspoken rule that, of course, they can do that, but they could never be the lead pastor, for example.
Right.
How does that kind of thinking come about? And where is that from? Like, where are people getting that from? And what would you say, to sort of put them right, as it were?
Yeah. So in the UK, I think one of the traditions that people would probably look back to would be its medieval Christian roots, in which we do see this, especially beginning when we, you know, and I talk about this actually a lot in Becoming the Pastor's Wife, where I talk about the history of ordination, and that ordination has a major shift in the Central Middle Ages, where it moves from being tied to a specific job that you're ordained to serve in this place, to being a state of being, that you are able to perform the sacraments. And this is a really big shift in the Central Middle Ages. And it is during this shift that we begin to see women being pushed out of ordained roles, unless they are just female monastics, and the power of female monastics begins to be eroded at this time too. So this is a shift where the medieval Catholic world is not uniform in not ordaining women. The other thing is that I've even learned as a medievalist, is that even though the the narrative is that women can't be priests, that this was never fully accepted in the medieval world, that there were always people, both men and women, who actually disagreed with that and fought against that. And so it was contested throughout all of medieval history, which is something that we don't hear too. We just hear sort of, you know, the people who won or who told the story, who say women can't do this. So I would say in the UK, sort of this idea that women can't do these top leadership positions, part of this is rooted in what this understanding, I think, of the medieval past, that women weren't ever able to serve in these roles, which isn't a fully accurate story. I think it is reinforced, too, in the roots of Anglicanism itself, which is born in the Reformation. And it's in the Reformation that we really begin to see gender roles become encoded into what it means to be an ideal Christian. And this is where we see these big shifts in the family that, and I talk about this in The Making of Biblical Womanhood, you know, that it's rooted in these changing economic ideals where we get that the holy household is this, the husband who's in charge of the labor in the home and his wife who then is underneath him, and then the children. And this is really kind of a new concept that we see begin to be introduced in the Reformation. And it's no surprise, too, that it's at the Reformation that the pastor's wife role is born. It doesn't look the way that it looks today, but it is not a concept in Christian history until the Reformation era. And so, you know, for people who say that ministers have always, there's always been pastor's wives, there is a difference between being married to a minister and being a pastor's wife. And the pastor's wife role is not a concept until the Reformation era. And then, you know, has changed significantly. So I think, now going back to your original question about lead pastor, and you can interrupt me at any time, this is actually a really recent intervention into the conversation. And it has to do with changing church structures and also trying to, to figure out how do we allow women to serve in roles that we need them to serve in, but still say that we're adhering to this complementarian framework. And the way to do that is to create this hierarchical understanding of leadership roles in the church. So you have the main pastor or the executive pastor, the preaching pastor, and then everybody else is underneath them. And as long as that person's safely a man, then that's okay. And then they say, oh, well, now everybody else is under his authority, so a woman is not teaching or holding authority over the man because she's under the male pastor. And, you know, I always challenge people to go tell me where there's a lead pastor in the Bible. It's not a lead pastor. You won't even find an understanding of really the pastoral role in the Bible. The word is mostly used for shepherding. It's an action. It's not a position. And so that in of itself tells me that the way that we have constructed the pastoral role is a modern construction. It is not actually a biblical pattern.
But some people would argue that this comes from the Bible verses that talk about male headship and yep. the man being yep. the head of the woman as Christ is the head of the church. How does that unpack?
Yeah. So,
I'm just throwing all the hard questions at you.
It's really good. And, you know, I mean, these are the things. So the first thing that I always tell people is that we have to look at the Bible as a whole, as I've already said. And so while we do have those male headship passages, we have to think about, okay, well, what does this mean? What does this mean at this time? And the thing that we see actually in those headship passages is that there is, like even in Ephesians, Ephesians starts off with, submit unto one another as to the Lord. And then it says, wives, submit to your husbands. And then it says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And this is actually a very different conversation about submission than what we find in the broader Roman world, in which, you know, husbands legally had the power of life and death over their wives. And now that is being flipped. And husbands are being told, no, 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 you don't have power over them. You lay down your life for them. And so it really is this inversion of this Roman context of submission. And then I think we also think about how male-female roles play out, especially if we're think about leadership in the early church. And there are very few examples of that we see in the Bible of spouses. Actually, you know, most people, we have no idea if they're married or not. And I do a dive on this in Becoming the Pastor's Wife. I have a chapter called Where is Peter's Wife? And sort of this idea that we don't know who we don't we know very little about most of the relationships of people in the early church. And when we do see them functioning together, we really see them functioning on par. You can think about Aquila and Priscilla, in which Priscilla seems to be the primary ministry partner. And I don't think that the way Priscilla is presented in the Bible seems to push against those very conservative readings of the household code passages. And so I would say, yes, they are in the Bible, but they are always in that context of we are called to submit to each other as to the Lord. And that really erodes the idea of head. And so I think we have to think really hard about taking maybe one verse, as we see, you know, often in 1 Corinthians, where it talks about Christ is the head, you know, and the husband is the head of the home, as Christ is the head of the church. That's like one of the most difficult verses in the entire Bible to understand. It is clearly rooted in a cultural issue that is going on. And it is, and thinking about headship in the way that we think about headship today, that clearly is not what's going on in that passage. And so I think, you know, my mom would always say one verse, theologians, people who take one verse and they use it to construct their entire theology. And that is always a bad idea. And I think that's, and it always strikes me that we choose the verses about women to construct our entire theology that says they can't be in leadership instead of looking at all the other places God is using women in the Bible.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Now, we've seen in recent years so many painful episodes come to light of church abuse and church scandal. And many people have argued that complementarianism is causing these abuse issues. Would you agree with that? Is it as strong a correlation as that? Or is there something going on within church models where male leadership is prioritized that can become harmful?
Yeah. I don't think complementarianism causes abuse. I think complementarianism creates an environment in which male leaders are more likely to be believed and more and less likely to be held accountable. And that is an environment in which abusive people are able to flourish for longer and there's fewer checks and balances on them. And so I think that's what, you know, complement this, when you create this authoritarian structure in which you say the only people who can be at the top and in leadership are men, they're only listening to male voices. Men tend to, and I mean, I saw this so much in so much of this literature, men tend to give each other the benefit of the doubt, I think more so. It's like, oh, well, you didn't really mean that there. Or that really wasn't that inappropriate of a hug. It was just misunderstood, et cetera. And so there tends to be more benefit of the doubt given, and you have no female voices speaking into that, being like, wait, 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 no, no, no. That's actually not what's going on. And so it allows people to get away with things for longer. You know, sort of this good old boy system. And it's, you know, we see abuse flourishing also in egalitarian spaces. Willow Creek is a really good example in the U.S. But what is similar about it to complementarian churches is that it still had this authoritarian structure. And it still had a male pastor at the top with very few checks and balances on him. And women who brought up concerns were pushed out and, you know, and discredited. And so, and that's the same structure that we see, you know, that emphasis on a male leader with very few checks and balances. That's a structure that is encouraged and much more likely to be present in complementarian systems.
So both sexes working together as God designed is probably going to be healthier, is the bottom line.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's not that women should be running everything, because they shouldn't be. I mean, God made us to work together. And so it's just, it's amazing to me that we keep having to convince the church when from the very beginning, God said, it's not good to be alone. You need each other. And yet we keep saying, no, 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 it's better to have the man working alone.
Mm. Is this personally costly for you? Like, is it exhausting? Mm-hmm. Have you had much pushback? How does it affect you having to keep fighting this fight?
Yeah. So the making a biblical womanhood was absolutely exhausting. It still is exhausting. I tell people the aftermath of the making a biblical womanhood aged me. You know, I say people look at pictures of me before I wrote it and after I wrote it. And there is a significant, I mean, I age significantly during that time. Becoming the pastor's wife was actually a really challenging book for me to write, because it's a hard book. I talk about, you know, there were really hard parts in it for me to write. And as I was learning them, and I was like, oh my gosh, how do we get out of this? So the writing the book itself was actually really hard on me. But I also found that, you know, as hard as the process has been, I also have seen so much fruit coming from this. And, you know, I still get letters from women all over the world telling me how learning the history of this and learning, you know, I think about this one young woman who wrote me from China, and she said, I found my Jesus again. And I realized that God was for me and not against me. And, you know, I just like, that makes it all worth it. The fact that women are being freed to move into what God has always called them to do, and that churches are being empowered to let all of their people serve freely, that makes it worth it. And so, yes, it's exhausting, but I'm really glad that I've been able to use my skills in a way that has served the church.
So let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the church right now. And you mentioned earlier the rise in Christian nationalism, which, you know, we're seeing in the US and across Europe, and is, you know, deeply concerning. And then on the other hand, we've got this beautiful Gen Z renewal going on, and reports of more people coming to faith, more young people coming to faith, particularly young men coming to faith.
Yeah.
How do you see this issue playing out in the next generation of Christians, and especially those coming into leadership and coming into our churches for the first time? I'm particularly thinking about young people that I know in my own context, in my own local town, who have found Jesus in their late teens, early 20s, from a completely unchurched background. And one of them in particular came to me and said, I've always been a feminist. I'm really into social justice issues. How do I grapple with Paul's writings? And her immediate perception was that the church was against women, and she didn't know how to reconcile this beautiful Jesus that she'd found in a bedroom by herself with what she was then starting to sort of maybe hear and pick up from inside the church, and she didn't like it. So I think we're going to see this sort of clash of cultures and questions. Yeah. Is there hope that things are going to change? Is it going to, you know, what's going to happen? How do you see that playing out?
Yeah. So I've been watching this, you know, this Gen Z revival too. I see it going on around me in the context of the U.S. And in the U.S., it is really apparent that there's this gender difference, that there are more young men. The churches that they tend to be going to are these much more conservative churches that are also connected to things like Christian nationalism and very hard gender roles. So on the one hand, yes, people coming to faith in Jesus is always something to celebrate and something that we want. But I think we should also be asking really hard questions about why it is more men who are going, and they're going to these more conservative churches, whereas young women are not as attracted to those spaces. And I think, you know, and I think part of it, it definitely is this, the way the church has emphasized male-female roles, in which they have written men automatically into leadership and told women they need to tone it down. And this is a message that is going to have significant implications for the future of the church if it continues in that way. And one of them, of course, is, how do churches function without women? You know, how do churches function without women? Historically, it has always been the opposite. More women have been in church than men. And so what does it mean that that's moving? Even in small ways, what does that mean? Now, the thing that I would say is encouraging about this is that this younger generation, like the student who came to you or the young person who came to you, they actually seem to be questioning these things more than perhaps my generation did, where my inner generation just kind of accept, oh yeah, this is what the Bible teaches. Whereas these, you know, younger folk who are more involved in social justice issues, and they're like, whoa, 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 what? What is this? This does not sound good. And so that gives me a lot of encouragement that they're like, yes, Jesus, wait, the way we're teaching what Jesus is supposed to do, that doesn't sound right. Mm. And I think that dissonance is what gives me hope. because I think that questioning early on, and if they can ask those questions and keep asking those questions, then that can maybe lead us to a better, healthier church in which women and men, and maybe that women can begin to see a place for themselves in it again.
Amen.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.